This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Polls open in Venezuela's parliamentary elections, in which President Maduro is tipped to win with an overwhelming majority. Tehran criticizes the UN nuclear watchdog for its flawed confidentiality mechanisms. It says that the IAEA is responsible for a leak of a recent confidential memo. The EU and Britain's chief negotiators are set to meet in Brussels in their last-ditch effort to secure a post-Brexit trade deal. It's a great pleasure to have you with us. Now, starting with Venezuela, polls open in that country for National Assembly elections, in which President Maduro's socialists are tipped to win with an overwhelming majority. The entire 227 seats in the lower house of parliament are up for grabs. Maduro has pledged to resign immediately if his party loses the vote. He's facing allegations of vote fraud by his opponents. Some opposition groups, including the independent party of U.S.-backed opposition leader Juan Guaido, have boycotted the election. Now, this is amid the U.S. and Europe's campaign of pressure and sanctions to force Maduro to leave office. The Western governments had unilaterally declared Guaido as Venezuelan president. Now, to Guatemala people, they have taken to the streets for the third consecutive Saturday to protest against the government of President Alejandro Giammattei. The protesters marched through the capital, Guatemala City, carrying banners and signs while chanting anti-government slogans. They demand the resignation of Giammattei, whom they accuse of corruption. The unrest followed the passage of a federal budget over 2 weeks ago. On Friday, Giammattei, however, assured the public that the budget would include transparency and accountability mechanisms. The unrest snowballed into a wider movement, with people highlighting other socioeconomic problems. Guatemala is facing an economic crisis as it's dealing with the aftermath of the coronavirus pandemic and two major storms. Iran says it'll shortly take legal action over a leak of confidential letters sent by Tehran to the International Atomic Energy Agency. Iran's permanent representative to the Vienna-based international organizations held the IAEA responsible for that incident. Azem Gharibadi says the agency's confidentiality mechanisms are seriously flawed. He noted that Iran's reports to the agency have been repeatedly divulged to media while still considered to be confidential. Gharibabadi stressed that reporting confidential information without following the declassification procedure is illegal. The letter contained information on Iran's safeguard measures in its nuclear enrichment plant in the central city of Natanz. Our correspondent in Vienna says that Iran is concerned that a leak of information about its nuclear program could endanger the security of its nuclear facilities and also the lives of its nuclear scientists.
But this isn't the first time that this has happened. This has happened numerous times before, especially when it comes to the reports that the agency has on monitoring and verification of the JCPOA in Iran. So this has happened before. There certainly hasn't been a sense of urgency when it came to previous instances. And right now, with the tweet that the Iranian ambassador gave, there hasn't still been any official response from the IAEA. The IAEA has generally said before that it takes the issue of confidentiality seriously. Iran says the only option that Iran is left with is to pursue this legally, because this has not just happened today or this time, it's happened before, And in some cases, Iran is saying it has actually endangered the lives of Iranian nuclear scientists. The names of people who've been mentioned in these reports, for instance, those people have come under threat. We know about, of course, the assassinations of nuclear scientists and the sabotage attempts against Iranian nuclear facilities. So this has real consequences for Iran. And unfortunately, it's only the reports on Iran that are leaked to the media and not reports on other countries, because, of course, that's because the IAEA has the most extensive inspections regime in Iran.
The EU and Britain's chief Brexit negotiators will make a last-ditch effort to break months of deadlock on future trade relations between London and Brussels. EU's Michel Barnier and his British counterpart David Frost are supposed to resume talks once again to try and find common ground on the critical issue that have split both sides. Now, that extra time came after Prime Minister Johnson of Britain and EU Chief Ursula von der Leyen held an emergency phone conversation on Saturday. The two agreed that significant differences remain, but negotiations should continue. Britain left the EU at the end of January, but remains under EU trading rules. The two sides must reach a deal before the Brexit transition period ends on December the 31st. Our Brussels correspondent Jerome Hughes says the talks that the EU and Britain's chief negotiators are going to hold are the most intensive ones held so far in this regard.
They're going to have, we keep hearing this word, it's a bit of a cliche at this stage, but intensive negotiations. And I think because of the time frame involved here, these really will be the most intensive negotiations so far. Because Michel Barnier, the EU's chief negotiator, he is actually, he is due to brief the EU ambassadors tomorrow morning, Monday, to give them the latest position in terms of these talks. And then Ursula von der Leyen, the head of the Commission, and Boris Johnson, the British Prime Minister, then are due to hold sort of another call Monday evening, tomorrow evening, to basically see if they have come to an agreement. But there are a few different things happening here. I mean, just as worth mentioning as well, you mentioned about the chances of a deal. Well, the Irish Foreign Minister, in a newspaper article that's published today, Simon Coveney, he says that a trade deal is 97 or 98% complete. So that gives you an idea that really this is almost finalized, you could say. But the major issue, I mean, apart from we keep talking about the 3 points, but the big point in all of those is the EU having access to the UK's fishing waters.
A fresh protest rally has taken place all over France against a new security law. Protesters demand the cancellation of important parts of that law. They denounce an authoritarian drift of the French government. Our correspondent has more.
The coordination Stop Global Security Law organized a new popular march for liberties and for justice all over France. The protesters want a total withdrawal of a law recently voted in the French parliament that limits the possibility to film the police. They also denounce an authoritarian drift of the French government.
That authoritarian drift is evident. Look to the purpose laws. The existing legal framework in France is more than sufficient to control everything they want to. Why do they add new laws? It's only to limit more the freedom of expression and to sanction activists.
Trade unions say that the French government is taking advantage of the COVID-19 crisis to implement anti-social and austerity measures like the privatization of the health sector and the dismissal of workers.
They use the Terrorist Act and the health crisis as an alibi for restrictive measures. Since last week, the head of police has forbidden a demonstration in name of the COVID-19 crisis. This law has only one interest, to silence demonstrators.
Earlier this week, the Council of Ministers decided to close the main association against Islamophobia in France, the CCIF. French Interior Minister Darmanin qualified the CCIF as an enemy of the Republic and accused it of incitement to hatred and violence, discrimination, and of encouraging terrorism.
That's very surprising, because the CCIF has always profiled itself on the judicial scene and very little as political activists. The association limited itself to defend the legitimate rights of the Muslims. Now, in the context of an upsurge of terrorist attacks since 2015, the French government has entered in a phase of escalation of repressive measures that seriously limit the democratic liberties.
Amnesty International declared that dissolving the CCIF is a violation of freedom of association. As for now, the French government remains inflexible towards a social protest. But tensions are rising in high government circles about the way the security issue in France is handled. The protesters promise not to give up until an important part of the law is cancelled. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
In Romania, people are heading for the polls to cast their ballots in parliamentary elections amid the coronavirus crisis. The ruling National Liberal Party is tipped to win the vote, with Prime Minister Ludovic Orban promising to modernize the nation. Orban has been running a minority government for the past year and trying to keep Romania on a pro-EU path. His party has the backing of President Klaus Iohannis. The main opposition Social Democratic Party is projected to come second. Pandemic is expected to depress the voter turnout, limiting it to around 40%. First official results are expected later in the evening. South Korea has announced fresh curbs after registering its highest daily coronavirus infections in 9 months. The restrictive measures that include unprecedented curfews and business shutdowns affect the capital Seoul and the nearby areas. Restrictions will remain in force for at least 3 weeks. Other areas of the country will also see heightened social distancing rules. Authorities have added more than 630 new cases, bringing the tally to over 37,000. The death toll hovers around 550. Many of the recent cases have been centered in Seoul. The health ministry has warned of a very dangerous situation. Fatalities from COVID-19 in the United States have surpassed the grim milestone of 280,000 as the virus is wreaking havoc across that country. The U.S. once again shattered its record for daily COVID-19 cases for the third day in a row, some 230,000 new infections there. Total confirmed cases now exceeding 14,500,000 in the U.S., which remains the world's worst country in terms of both infections and deaths. Top American health expert Anthony Fauci says that some areas may need to reimpose draconian measures. Meanwhile, in Brazil, authorities reported 43,000 new cases and 660 deaths. That raises Brazil's overall death toll to 176,000 out of more than 6.5 million cases. President Donald Trump has reiterated his claim of election fraud in the last month's presidential vote.
I think they say that if you win Florida and if you win Ohio, in history, you've never lost an election. This has got to be a first time. But the truth is, they were right. We've never lost an election. We're winning this election.
How is that constitutional?
Trump made a comment in a campaign rally for two Georgia Republican senators who are facing runoffs in early January. The president and some of his fellow Republicans have rejected the results of the November 3rd election. They claim that a vote was rigged in favor of the Democrats. Their claims, however, have been rejected by state and federal officials, and their numerous legal challenges have almost all failed. In the meantime, Joe Biden officially secured the 270 electoral votes needed to enter the Oval Office, just after California certified his victory there. Colin Campbell says that Trump's claims of fraud may have repercussions for his Republican comrades in Senate who are trying to maintain their narrow majority.
The president's claims and his continued persistence that the vote is not legitimate has created problems for Republicans in Georgia and in other areas, whereas the Republicans in Georgia, some of them are saying that they won't vote at all because they believe that the system is corrupt. And this creates a problem for Republicans because they have a narrow margin of majority in the Senate. They need their candidates to win in Georgia. And there are two candidates running right now, Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue. If they don't win, if they lose to Ossoff and Dr. Raphael Warnock, then the balance swings to a 50-50 split. And who breaks that 50-50 split if there is a disagreement over legislation? Well, none other than the vice president. And right now, the vice president-elect, Kamala Harris, is expected to become officially the vice president on January 20th. So if you have a current president who's saying that the vote is illegitimate and that the system is corrupt and that the voting is rigged, and Republicans believe this narrative that their vote really doesn't count and they don't come out to show up for the election, well, then he's essentially handing it over to Democrats, which would further mire any type of influence that the Republicans wish to have with a Democrat in the executive branch and, of course, a majority of Democrats in the House of Representatives.
Now, in other news, the European Union has denounced the killing of a Palestinian teenager by the Israeli army as a war crime. The EU delegation to Palestine called for a thorough investigation into that incident, noting that international law recognizes special protection for minors. The fatal shooting of the teenager also drew condemnation from the United Nations Middle East envoy. Nikolai Mladenov said that he was appalled by the killing that he described as shocking and unacceptable. Palestinian factions also denounced it. Ali Abu Elia was targeted with a bullet during a Friday protest against Israeli settlements in a village near the city of Ramallah. He was laid to rest on Saturday in the course of a funeral. Pakistan's economy is significantly dependent on remittances from Persian Gulf Arab states. Now, some reports have it that the country has come under pressure by a number of Arab rulers to normalize relations with Israel. And that has cast a shadow on Pakistan's long-standing relations with the leading Arab states. Javed Rana has the story.
Protest in Pakistan against the UAE was unthinkable until recently. However, now it is not so unusual after the UAE diplomatically recognized the apartheid regime of Israel. The public sentiments against several Arab rulers rose in Pakistan after the UAE and Bahrain started aligning their foreign policies with Israel and India. The normalization of Israel's ties with the UAE and Bahrain is now affecting Islamabad's long-standing relation with some Arab rulers, particularly of Saudi Arabia and UAE. Citing unspecified security threats and rise in coronavirus cases, the UAE now has banned visit and work visas to Pakistani citizens, along with 13 other Muslim nations, most of whom have been angry with Abu Dhabi after it normalized ties with Tel Aviv.
Countries like UAE receive such direct investment from investors from Israel and, for that matter, American Jewish community, then obviously the UAE government and the investors from Israel or, for that matter, USA would be cautious about how the local population, for that matter, how the immigrants might react and respond to direct presence of the Israeli, or for that matter, American Jewish investors in countries like UAE.
Without revealing their names, Prime Minister Imran Khan in a recent interview dropped a hint that Saudi Arabia and the UAE have been pressurizing Islamabad to normalize its ties with Israel. Islamabad has vowed not to give diplomatic recognition to Israel. Over 5 million Pakistanis work in UAE and Saudi Arabia, the two biggest remittance-generating Arab states.
Pakistan's economy is dependent on these remittances. Saudi Arabia and UAE have the tools in their hands to put pressure on Pakistan to recognize Israel. Pakistan's nuclear power has always been a problem for Israel. So therefore, Israel would love that Pakistan should give recognition to it. That's why UAE, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and other GCC countries want Pakistan to give recognition to Israel.
Political analysts say that Pakistan is running out of options, and in the current situation, it may inch closer to Turkey, Qatar, Iran, and more particularly to China to offset pressure from Saudi Arabia and UAE, which are strengthening their alliance with Israel, US, and India. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Well, that brings us to the end of this broadcast from Tehran.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa by a shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense.
They gave Saddam Mirage to bombard us, super ethundered for striking our ships, as well as giving him satellite information on the movement of our forces and the places where they stated. Their assistance to the Iraqis ranged from money to tanks, chemical weapons, and all sorts of other things. They even gave him chemical weapons, and Saddam used them against us. He also used them against his own nation. In Halabja, he used chemical weapons, and in our country too. He used them many times. In other words, the West and Europe violated and trampled upon all their philanthropic and human rights claims in their interaction with the Iraqis. They invalidated all their claims by defending the corrupt, dictatorial, and anti-human regime of Saddam. Having a deep understanding about these matters is very precious to us. We should really know who Westerners are, and we should decide, think, and work accordingly.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
The last point that I want to raise is that a great incident occurred in the sacred defense era. The fact that it revealed the capabilities and capacities of the Iranian nation to the whole world. In other words, it turned into a medium. All media in the world were against us. Global media were against the revolution. Of course, the same situation exists today. It was also the case at that time. In the beginning of the revolution, official media in the world either lied, denied our strong points, or slandered everyone, including Imam, the government of the Islamic Republic, the masses of the people, the judiciary branch, the armed forces, and everyone else. They worked continuously against them, and they wanted to portray the Iranian nation as bad people in the eyes of people all over the world.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to
The imperialist war of aggression against Syria has been raging on now for almost a decade. Foreign actors haven't interfered just on the battlefield. They've also been waging a war of words and ideas using a vast propaganda network. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. In 2011, during the so-called Arab Spring, what started out in Syria as a supposed popular uprising or a revolution quickly turned out to be a very complex proxy war involving numerous actors, very powerful Western governments, and Arab kingdoms in the Persian Gulf. Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Israel, the United Kingdom, the United States worked together to fund and train hardline Islamist groups inside of Syria in order to implement regime change and overthrow the Syrian government. These groups were supplied with radios, medical equipment, weapons, munitions, and much more. However, the war against Syria hasn't been waged just with weapons and just on the battlefield. It's also involved words, ideas, propaganda. And so these nations wielded the power of the mainstream media in order to craft a certain narrative and change public opinion about what is going on inside of Syria. One of the biggest lies of this war is the alleged gas attack that took place in Douma, a scandal that continues to this day. In April 2018, we heard allegations that the Syrian army had dropped chemical weapons on civilians in Douma. Now, at this time, the Syrian army was undertaking Operation Damascus Steel to take back the region of Ghouta, which is in the countryside of Damascus. Most of Ghouta was already back under the government's control. So why would they use chemical weapons when they're winning this campaign? That makes absolutely no sense strategically or militarily. Why would the Syrian government do the one thing that would guarantee foreign intervention and a bombing campaign by the US and the UK? That makes absolutely no sense. Moreover, the Syrian government had already gotten rid of its chemical weapons stockpile in 2014, which was overseen by the international community. So where are these weapons coming from exactly? Nonetheless, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, sent a fact-finding mission to Douma to investigate what had taken place. Thanks to leaked emails published by WikiLeaks in late 2019, we can see how the OPCW doctored its own report to remove the findings of the team that it sent to Douma. Why? Because these findings showed that no chemical gas attack had taken place. Bit by bit, we saw how inspectors complained internally that what was being shown in the preliminary report did not match what they found on the ground. The fact-finding mission that was sent by the OPCW concluded that the gas cylinders were not dropped from an aircraft, but had been placed there manually. The inspectors also concluded that there were only trace quantities of chlorine. These could have emanated from household items like bleach. Moreover, the medical examinations showed that the victims, the symptoms that they exhibited did not match those of a chemical gas attack. The OPCW leadership removed these findings from their report because they disproved these allegations that the Syrian army had used chemical weapons. One of the whistleblowers who came forward with these revelations is Ian Henderson. And when he did, the OPCW tried to discredit him, which is absurd considering the fact that Henderson is a veteran inspector at the OPCW and was leading the mission that went to Douma.
The findings in the final FFM report were contradictory, were a complete turnaround with what the team had understood collectively. During and after the Douma deployments, and by the time of release of the interim report in July 2018, our understanding was that we had serious misgivings that a chemical attack had occurred.
20 OPCW inspectors expressed their concerns about the report being doctored. And the OPCW then decided to replace the fact-finding mission with a new one. An entirely new team was assembled with members who had not been to the site, save for one medical expert. The evidence is clear. The science is clear. The chemical weapons inspectors themselves from the OPCW could not find any evidence of a chemical gas attack. This has never been corrected by the OPCW nor the mainstream media. As a matter of fact, the United Kingdom, the United States, France didn't even wait for the OPCW report, for this doctored report to even come out. They just went right ahead and bombed Syria a few days later in April 2018. And last month in October, these same countries blocked Jose Bustani, the former director of the OPCW, from testifying at the UN Security Council.
Of particular concern are the circumstances surrounding the OPCW's investigation of the alleged chemical attack in Douma, Syria, on April the 7th, 2018. These concerns are emanating from the very heart of the organization, from the very scientists and engineers involved in the Duma investigation. Now, almost 1 year later, the OPCW has still not responded to these requests, nor to the ever-growing controversy surrounding the Duma investigation. Rather, it has hidden behind an impenetrable wall of silence and opacity, making any meaningful dialogue impossible. The inspectors in the Duma investigation have a simple request, that they be given the opportunity to meet with you, Mr. Chairman, to express their concerns to you in person, in a manner that is both transparent and accountable. If the OPCW is confident in the robustness of its scientific work on Duma and in the integrity of the investigation, then it should have little to fear in hearing out its inspectors. If, however, the claims of evidence suppression, selective use of data, and exclusion of key investigators, among other allegations, are not unfounded, then it's even more imperative that the issue be dealt with openly and urgently.
When Bustani was the head of the OPCW during the Bush years, John Bolton came to The Hague personally and threatened him and his family if he did not resign, because he was getting in the way of Washington's attempts to topple Saddam Hussein and go for regime change in Iraq. And so when José Bustani tried to testify at the UN Security Council and plead that the OPCW listen to its own inspectors and look at the science, look at the evidence from the Duma site, he was blocked. I don't think the irony is lost on anyone that in this same chamber, this same body, in front of the UN Security Council in 2003, Colin Powell sat there and lied about weapons of mass destruction that Iraq did not possess. And here we are 17 years later, in front of the same body, and we're seeing the same movie being played out. How anyone can believe allegations about WMDs emanating from Western governments after 2003 is truly beyond me. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
One of the key voices in amplifying these allegations of chemical weapons being used, and not just in Duma, by the way, are the white helmets. You may have heard about the white helmets or seen their videos where they're running in the midst of battle and rescuing victims from the rubble, being portrayed as these benevolent actors. But the truth is far more sinister than that. Just recently, a trove of leaked documents revealed in detail how the United Kingdom and its allies poured millions of pounds into contractor groups. These contractor groups were created by former British intelligence and set up in countries near Syria like Turkey and the United Arab Emirates. They included groups like ARC or IncoStrat, Albany, and all of them founded by figures with backgrounds in British intelligence, in the British military, or the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. These organizations were not only created by Western intelligence, they were funded by the same countries trying to overthrow the Syrian government and implement regime change in Syria. These groups like ARC worked very closely with Western mainstream media in order to craft this narrative about the war in Syria and change public opinion. They pushed the line that Syria and Russia are evil and amplified the voices of opposition figures, and even tried to rehabilitate the image of hardline Islamist groups as moderate rebels. So while the Western media tried to portray the white helmets as these noble humanitarian actors, and Netflix even produced an Oscar-winning documentary, and they were nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, what the Western media never told you is that their founder, James Lemessurier, is not a Syrian. He's British former intelligence and former army. And all these Western cutouts that were funding the white helmets and running their social media accounts and trying to rehabilitate the image of jihadists as moderate rebels, we're being run and funded by the same governments trying to overthrow the Syrian government and implement regime change in Syria. That part was conveniently left out, as were the parts about the white helmets participating in executions on video and using the same offices and headquarters as Al-Nusra Front, which is an offshoot of Al-Qaeda. I'm joined by Canadian journalist Eva Bartlett. Eva, you spent a long time in Syria. You covered Douma and the White Helmets. Could you tell us more about your time there?
I first went to Syria in April 2014. I spent a couple of weeks there with a peace delegation and afterwards came back on a journalist visa in June 2014. And since then, I've been to Syria 14 times. At points during 2016, I was spending 2 months and then later on 2 months.
You did a lot of coverage on the White Helmets. You've received a lot of attacks because of this in the mainstream media. Why is that? What did you discover exactly about the White Helmets that they don't like?
Yeah, I mean, I would also just add to it, the mainstream media doesn't like to hear anything from Syrian civilians that doesn't mesh with their narrative on Syria, which is, you know, everything about the Syrian government and army bad, everything about their precious quote-unquote rebels good. And so yeah. what other journalists, primarily Vanessa Bili, as you know, and myself have discovered is that the White Helmets are not the virtuous rescue team that their backers would have us believe. They're heavily funded by Western governments, working hand in hand with Al-Qaeda and other extremists in Syria. And you know, this is all right. From information that's available online. But then when you talk to Syrian civilians, they'll tell you about how they, for example, could not get close to the White Helmets because they were not allowed to. I was told that by numerous civilians, which begs the question, how are the White Helmets rescuing so many people if civilians tell us that we can't go near them because they're always with the terrorist groups? Civilians also spoke of White Helmets going with terrorists and staging scenes that presumably were like some sort of rescue scene, instead of throwing smoke bombs and then pretend rescuing people. I mean, this is civilian testimony, but I did hear it numerous times. And they, in Aleppo in 2018, an older man I spoke with near the citadel told me, quote, he said the civil defense, which is the name they go by, is supposed to rescue people, but they used to steal women's earrings from their dead bodies. She was wearing gold. They cut her hand to steal it. They're thieves, not rescuers. We saw them murdering people many times. So, and I also was in Eastern Ghouta some weeks after the allegations of a chemical attack having occurred there, and I spent a few hours walking around different districts, Douma, Kapakna, Safa, talking with people, and I was asking, of course, you know, did they have any information about whether or not a chemical attack had occurred? Because you would assume living in those areas, they'd either experienced it or their loved ones in the area had experienced it. And none of them had anything to say. They all thought it was, they either didn't have anything to say or they thought no attack had occurred. Some speculated that it was Jaish al-Islam trying to intimidate them, which was a common thing that terrorists do, by the way. They intimidate civilians there by saying, you know, if you leave this area, the Syrian government or the Syrian army is going to murder you, rape your women. So some are speculating that at the time that they were being, you know, intimidated by Jaish al-Islam. But most of them wanted to tell me about how horrible their lives had been under, whether it was Jaish al-Islam or Falah al-Khan or whichever, you know, how they'd been starved and tortured and how there was point-blank executions in the streets for all to see. So this is the kind of thing that most of the people I was meeting wanted to tell me about. But I did ask them about White Helmets. And so, for example, again, I heard they were only working with terrorist groups, Jaish al-Islam. They were supposed to be for civilians, but they were the contrary. And one guy said, Jaish al-Islam used to attack us wearing a white helmet one day, and leaving it behind another day. And so I have other testimonies from people from those areas. But also, I think just one other thing to note is that in Douma, in the medical point, the underground makeshift hospital that we all saw in White Helmets and other clips purporting to be treating civilians that were allegedly attacked with a chemical weapon, I spoke with medical staff there who told me, as this is now a very well-known story, but anyway, he said, you know, what staff were treating were people that were coming in for normal shelling injuries, suffocation injuries, gas or dust inhalation. I asked them, like, were any of the staff wearing protective uniforms if they had allegedly been treating chemical weapons victims? He said, of course not. And I said, well, were any of the staff ill or anything like that? And he said, no. And he said, all the people that they treated that day were sent home.
The BBC released a new radio podcast where they tried to whitewash the image of James Le Mesurier and the White Helmets. And in it, they attacked you and they attacked Vanessa Bili. What are some of the other smears that they put in there?
Right, so I have to be honest, I haven't listened to the whole thing because it's appallingly awful and it's really painful to listen to. But they're running with a theme that, again, that the White Helmets are victims of an attack campaign led by Russia, and that myself and Vanessa and other people are under the thumb of Russia and Syria, and that we don't really know what we're doing kind of thing, and that we're just like allegedly just reading a script provided to us. This is the essence of what they're trying to purvey, even though Vanessa, as you know, has many video interviews with civilians on the White Helmets, and I have also. But the other funny thing was that, and it might seem like a minor point, and I personally don't care a whole lot, but it was just funny that in one of the episodes, they interviewed Sean Penn, a well-known actor, and he claims to have met Vanessa, and he describes her, I'm going to paraphrase, he didn't know if he was talking to a crazy activist, a Russian agent, or somebody who was perhaps telling the truth. Roughly what he said. But the thing was, he didn't meet Vanessa Bailey. I met him in late 2016. It was when I was in the US doing the speaking tour after I had left Aleppo in November 2016, and the city had been under intense terrorist attack. And so in my speaking tour, I was talking primarily about the suffering civilians in Aleppo were enduring under these bombardments, you know, with mortars, missiles, gas canister bombs, etc. And so I was touring, and I was in LA, and it was arranged for me to meet with Penn, and we met in his home for a couple of hours, and he seemed receptive to information on Syria. He had been there at least once, I was told. He seemed to be interested in what I had to say. It was with a great deal of surprise that he later described me as, that I learned that he described me as, you know, oh, crazy activist, I'm used to, but like a Russian agent, like, come on. But I did tweet at him. I haven't gotten a response, but the main point was, again, it's not about me. The point is, if you don't even know who you met in 2016, you know, Vanessa is considerably taller, as I said, blonder, more British than I am. And if he cannot remember that detail, how are we supposed to take as credible anything that he has to say about, you know, Syria, much less the White Helmet?
Did the BBC actually ever provide any evidence to refute your reporting?
No, it's never. It's always character assassination. And you mentioned a previous smear. There was a December 2017 smear by The Guardian, who had their expert, who happened to be a fashion and tech expert, approach us with a very incriminating series of questions about our relationship to the Syrian, Russian, and in my case, DPRK governments, and whether we had any funding by them, and how we were able to go to these countries. And of course, the insinuations were that we're stooges of these governments, right? But then the ensuing character assassinations the ensuing smears or reports that they issue are character assassinations. And they don't look at, for example, the testimonies of what Syrian civilians are saying about the conduct of the White Helmets, or seeing them walking with various terrorist factions, or the fact that White Helmets headquarters are almost always inevitably next door to Al-Qaeda or other terrorist headquarters. They don't look at any of that. They sling the slurs, you know, Russian agent, conspiracy theorist, a blogger, you know.
In the Western media, you know, the White Helmets are portrayed as these impartial humanitarian actors. You visited the complexes, the offices that they used in Syria. Can you tell us more about what you found there?
I mean, to be honest, I've gone to two. One was in Eastern Ghouta. In Sakhba, and it was 200 meters down the lane of a bomb-producing, bomb-manufacturing factory. I believe that was belonging to Falah al-Rahman. And the other one was in, the other headquarters I visited was in Al-Ansari, Eastern Aleppo. And it was in a school, and now the school has been rehabilitated to its normal function, but it was also just down the lane, like half a minute's walk from Al-Qaeda headquarters. And the point also that a local journalist in Aleppo made was that, you know, civilians could not access those areas. If they dared to come to those areas, they would be shot dead by the terrorists, because these were terrorist headquarters areas, and that was well known. So that's just another the point, you know, like if we're meant to believe that these rescuers, so-called, are interacting with people and saving them, then why is it that time and again, even before Aleppo was liberated, I spoke with a family that had managed to flee Eastern Aleppo in November 2016, and they told me they had tried many times before eventually fleeing. And when I asked them, did they know anything about the White Helmets or the Syrian civil defense, they said no. And when I asked people in Greater Aleppo who had loved ones and friends and relatives in Eastern Aleppo under their rule of terrorist groups, whether they knew about white helmets or civil defense. They said no, right? So, I mean, how is that possible? And Richard, if I can make one point, you know, I lived in Gaza. I worked with Palestinian medics in the war in Gaza in 2009. And so I was in very shoddy ambulances rushing to the scene of an Israeli terrorist attack. And basically, there was no time for theatrics. The medics got out of their ambulances, grabbed the body, assisted the people, and got the heck out of there. And so when I watch these videos with white helmets, I just think, like, even if you don't know anything about, you know, medical treatment, just watching them, and they're full of theatrics. It's just implausible that in a zone under bombings that they would act this way. There's no time. So that's another personal point, that these Palestinian rescuers, they're heroes, but you don't see them doing these types of theatrics is the best word for it, really.
You were in Douma, in Ghouta, shortly after this alleged gas attack in April 2018, and you spoke with residents and with medical staff who were there. What did they tell you?
Okay, well, I did talk about Marwan Jabber, the medical student that was in the hospital on April 7th. So again, what he told me was that they were treating, actually, this is interesting, he said, while staff were treating normal bombing injuries and bleeding cases, as he described them, asphyxiation, strangers entered screaming about a chemical attack, Kamaui, Kamaui, and started hosing people with water. And then he said hospital staff calmed the situation down and went back to treating the patients as normal shelling victims, as they didn't exhibit any indications of having been exposed to a chemical agent. So that was, I mean, a pretty damning testimony from somebody who was there.
In late 2019, when WikiLeaks published these internal documents from the OPCW showing that no chemical gas attack took place in Douma, how did it feel to have your reporting from a year and a half ago corroborated by the scientists who went to visit the site?
I mean, of course, it was very interesting to hear these people were speaking out, the OPCW whistleblowers were speaking out. But no, I'm sorry, I didn't expect, of course, mainstream media to give them any fair treatment. I expected either them to be derided, as anybody who speaks truthfully on Syria is, or simply to be ignored. Remembered, I wanted to make one point. So when I was in Isin Ghouta in 2018, I also went to Kafr Batna for a different purpose. Because if you remember, in 2013, Syria was accused of using chemical weapons. And in Kafr Batna, at the tuberculosis hospital, there were scenes allegedly of chemical weapons victims being treated there. So when I went in May 2018, I spoke with the hospital administrator, Mr. Mohammed Al-Akhwani, and he told me there wasn't a chemical attack. He said he wasn't at the hospital that night, but his staff told him what happened. He said around 2 a.m., there was suddenly noise, shouting, cars arriving at the hospital, bringing civilians. Some people, armed men, said there was a chemical attack. Some of them had foreign accents, which is interesting. They took people's clothes off and started pouring water on them, very much like 2018. They kept bringing people in until 7 a.m. I thought that was quite interesting because, you know, when that alleged attack occurred, it was coincidentally when OPCWs were already in Syria to investigate a prior allegation.
Ava, thanks for joining me. Thanks for your reporting. While Western governments and the Western mainstream media want you to believe that what's happening in Syria is a popular uprising or a revolution or an Arab Spring, the truth is far more sinister. When you have a dozen countries ganging up against Syria and funding armed terrorist groups and waging a massive disinformation campaign using a vast propaganda network, that's not a revolution anymore. That's not a popular uprising anymore. That's an imperialist war of aggression. The evidence behind the OPCW cover-up cannot be denied. The evidence behind the funding of these Western intelligence cutouts cannot be denied. The same people who lied to you about WMDs in Iraq, the same people who lied to you about Libya being liberated and turned a prosperous Arab African nation into a failed state, are also selling you these lies about Syria. And you should not believe them. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamadi.
Islamadi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, brothers and sisters, other life forms. You are listening to Youth Station.
Choo choo ka choo. It's a youth station for you. I'm Muzaffar Haider.
And I am Zainab. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's show. There were a group of people. They were all handed balloons, like blown up balloons. And they were asked to write their names on it and release the balloons into the room, mm-hmm. and like 12 people. And then there were maybe more, 25 people. And then they were asked to chase the balloon with their names on it and catch it.
Okay.
You see how sensitive balloons are? Like the draft that comes from your body mm-hmm, pursuing mm-hmm, it mm-hmm. pushes it farther away.
Yeah. And it goes really high up. So like how are they supposed to, did they have ladders?
It was not helium filled, bro. It was just normal balloon blown up with a person's mouth.
Well, that's just silly. So they're just running around this room, like trying to
chasing their balloons.
Balloon on the floor.
Yeah, but when they stood,
did anybody bump into each other?
They most probably did. It was probably embarrassing too. But the continuation of the story is not relevant to us. I'll tell it later. The point is, the more you chase something, it seems like the farther away it goes from you.
Ah.
Yeah.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, he said that the dunya is like your shadow. The more you chase it, the more it runs away from
beautiful.
You.
Beautiful.
The more you run away from it,
the more it chases you.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
beautiful. And yeah. that's exactly what it is. And that's exactly what I mean by let it go.
Uh-huh. Let it go.
Oh, my Lord. Frozen all over again. But I don't even like that cartoon. Oh, you've watched it a kajillion times on account of your daughter.
No. She ain't watching that.
My point is, let it go, you know? Because I feel like life experience. The more we hold on to something, the more